dissension in the church, those actually pushing back against predominant beliefs, has always been an issue in a church that values truth and unanimity in terms of what we believe and what we think. That was especially true in the early days, and it rose its head in New York and then in Kirtland. And then in Missouri, it became a major problem, both in terms of the dissent and how people handled that dissent to try and squash it. Join us today for a great class on dissension in Far West in 1838 and those that were traveling to be there to be part of that and how they handled all of that. Really a good class. Thanks for joining us today.
And welcome to another Monday morning Book of Mormon class with Kevin Hinckley. Recorded live, we dive deeply and deliberately into this inspired scripture. How far we get in one class depends a lot on the material and the doctrines left for us by ancient prophets. A single chapter may occupy one class or many. Of course, opinions expressed by the teacher or the class members do not constitute official church doctrines. Join us in this adventure and discover the hidden treasures found within his pages. And now, on to the class.
Well, with that said, with that as a background then, let's, I did get a picture of you. There's a chance it may show up on Facebook. Okay. All right. I want to start today with a 1838 revelation. Comes in January. That's not in our Doctrine and Covenants. There was a lot of revelations that Joseph Smith got and received that never were canonized, but they still give us an idea of what's going on. Here's what he got after struggling with everything in Kirtland, going out to Missouri, helping get things settled down in Missouri, and then coming back to Kirtland and finding out things are actually getting worse rapidly in Kirtland. He gets this revelation. Thus saith the Lord, let the presidency of my church take their families as soon as it's practical, and a door is open for them, and move on to the west as fast as way is made plain before their faces, and let their hearts be comforted, for I will be with them. Verily I say unto you, the time has come that your labors are finished in this place. For a season, therefore arise and get yourself to a land which I will show unto you, a land flowing with milk and honey. You are clean from the blood of this people, and woe unto those who have become your enemies. Okay. Now, this he received on the 12th of January. Guess which day Joseph and Sidney head for Missouri? The 13th. Thank you. They go the next day. In fact, but things are bad enough that Joseph and Sidney will first slip out of town. They will make arrangements to meet with their families will join them about 100 miles down the road, and then they will go to Missouri together. But that just gives you an idea of Kirtland is falling apart. And so they've got to get out of there. Now, and kind of to give you an idea of what comes next, I'm really aware that one of the things the church did when they got ready to rewrite the history of the church and they started putting together the volumes of saints and listening to the editor speak about saints, they said they were interested in a couple of things. They didn't want to make it a dusty documentary in scholarly discussion that nobody would want to read. So they framed saints, for those of you who have been able to read through saints, They wrote it at a level of that it would be understandable. They wrote it in terms of stories. And they wrote it in terms of the lives of people. So every time you get these things, you have the life of people and what they're actually going through, because then it makes it live. And so I started last week trying to start, when we look at things going on in church history, as much as possible, to see if we can't, if I can't find the lives of people that were living these experiences, because as you listen to what they're going through, suddenly this experience lives, because you see it through their eyes.
So then, is it a historical fiction, or is it a history that has been crafted in order to make it more palatable?
See, I think that's a really good question. In most cases, they said this was not going to be historical fiction. This was going to be historical nonfiction, because the stories that they were writing were going to come directly from journals and diaries, things that they're actually describing. Now, they might add a little bit of flesh to it, I guess, but
I think that they had novelists that were on the.
They did, so they could tell it in a story type history. Yeah.
In the later volumes, I've been a little disappointed that they didn't tell what the church was doing on a higher level.
Yeah.
It just becomes.
Yeah, they kind of swung all the way to the side of.
On the later, you know, you don't know. I want to know what Joseph F. Smith was doing, or you know, and or.
Yeah, you talk to one person, you're missing what everybody else is doing. That's exactly right. That's one of the reasons why it is I continue to love so much the historical write-up in the Joseph Smith papers, that every time I go into a section of the Doctrine and Covenants, I'm looking, the first thing I go to is the historical background, because they're providing all this data that has been put together, and they're giving you a more complex global view of this. But I have the advantage in some of this in that my pioneer grandfather, Arza Hinckley, I mentioned him a couple of times. He is a little bit like the Forrest Gump of church history. After Kirtland, he is everywhere. He's not prominent. He's like a wagon master. He's rescuing the handcart companies. He is in the Mormon Battalion. He's building the Nauvoo Temple. I mean, he's doing all of this stuff, but he's kind of quietly in the background. But I have his journals and the writings that he did do. He wasn't a great journalist. But to give you kind of a quick background on him, because he's going to provide some information about this, what's coming up. He's actually born in Canada in 1826. His father had died in Ohio. So he went to live with his grandfather, Arza, in Upper Canada near Toronto. And the gospel is preached to his family in 1836 with John E. Page. Now, it is true story, that right after the dedication of the Kirtland Temple, Joseph Smith has called John E. Page to go on a mission to Canada. Joseph and Oliver had been there, and he wanted Elder Page to go up there and preach. He's walking down the street, and Elder Page is still in Kirtland. And he says, "How come you're not in Canada?" And he says, "Well, I would, but it's cold up there. I don't have a coat." Joseph literally took off his own coat, gave it to John E. Page, says, "Now you do, now go." And it was on that mission, John E. Page then goes up with Peter Bleaksley, and they preach the gospel, and hundreds of people accept the gospel and are baptized, and they start little branches in what's called Upper Canada up there. Arza says in his journal that he was eight at the time that he first got the Book of Mormon, and he was shepherding his grandfather's sheep. And he said when he'd go out at night to watch over the sheep, they had one little Book of Mormon, and he would take that Book of Mormon out there and read it, and he says, "I just cried." You know, it just touched the heart of an eight-year-old. Testimony starts when he's eight. Now, When the revelation was given that the saints were now supposed to now gather to Missouri, finally, everybody's finally going to Zion. And the word is received in Upper Canada that everybody's gathering to Missouri. They then prepare to go. Now, the problem is that they had a small body of water between them and Kirtland, Lake Erie. How do we get down to Kirtland? If we go right away, we can cross over the frozen lake, which is what they did.
Taking the Edmund Fitzgerald.
Yeah, don't take the Edmund Fitzgerald. Or catch the Erie Canal and take it all the way down. They just... So in the dead of winter, they pack everything up, they cross down, they cross over the lake, and then they camp on the other side and then wait for it to get spring where they can travel. So that means that they arrive in Kirtland about late May of 1838. And what they find when they get to Kirtland is the wealthier saints have already left. Those that had some means had already packed up and were now on their way to Missouri. But the Canada saints are showing up almost 200 strong, and there are about another 300 poorer saints in Kirtland that are now preparing to make their way to Missouri. John E. Page is kind of the local, at that point he'd become a member of the Quorum of the Twelve. So he will organize a group of 500 Canadian and poorer Kirtland members to travel from Kirtland to Missouri, and they will call themselves the Kirtland Camp. Okay? And the Kirtland Camp has 500 people, but again, relatively poor. And they will now make their way across. Arza says that somewhere across Illinois, they recognized that he had not yet been baptized. So somewhere across Illinois, he says that he is now baptized, a member of the church at age 10.
Maybe he was born in 1828.
Did I...
Yeah.
Yeah, that would make sense, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, which is funny, because that's exactly right, but the last thing I said, it said 1826. I think that was wrong. Because he was definitely 10 at that point. And his first experience will be that when they arrive in Missouri, they will arrive, the first place they will land is in DeWitt, Missouri, and he will meet Joseph Smith for the first time, and then he will watch Joseph Smith negotiate with the mobs for the evacuation of DeWitt, Missouri, to bring them all back to Far West and Adamondiamond. Okay. All right. He will also be there, and we'll talk about this more next week. He's there, and he's an eyewitness to watching Joseph Smith and Parley and Sidney and others marched into the town square in Far West, and then get marched off to a jail there in November of 1838. And in fact, he will say, I'll just tell you this, part of what he says is that he's there for the siege, and he said that the mobs would let these boys, including Arza, lead the cattle and the sheep down to the river, the Grand River, to water at night. So they would go actually past all the armed mobs there, and then water them, and then bring them back. But they allowed the boys to do that. Okay. So this Kirtland camp, just to give you an idea. Oh, yeah. That would make a difference, wouldn't it? I wanted to show you this just so that... It's not very good, but that just gives you an idea. This Kirtland camp starts in Kirtland, and it makes it all the way down, and it's going to come across. So they're going to go down through Springfield, Indianapolis, not the other Springfield, and they'll end up over there in Missouri. Arza says in his journal that as you got 500 people marching along here, people would be a little bit alarmed about this massive wagon train of 500 people passing through town. And they'd say, well, what is this about? And Arza says, we were instructed to say, this is just a group of us heading west. And they'd say, well, who's in charge? And he was instructed to say, sometimes it's one person, sometimes it's another. But they were trying to be very careful as they tried to get this massive group of people, which would be a real anomaly. And then Kirtland Camp was the first organized Mormon migration, more than 500. It's organized under the direction of the Seven Presences of 70. The members of the Kirtland Camp covenanted to live by a constitution that provided guidelines concerning the camp's organization and set a code for its members. They traveled 800 miles that began in July 6th, and then they finally get to Davis County the 4th of October, 1838. Yay! Except that the siege on Far West happens October 31st, March 1st, March 2nd, like right in there. So they're only there about a month after making all the way out there, and then they're going to find a way to take care of themselves until they get back across the Mississippi to Quincy, Illinois, by the following year. But that gives you an idea of the length and everything that they were traveling on that. Isn't that amazing? Okay, questions on that?
I got a question about the sign before this thing where you showed the fancy historical marker.
Yeah, yes.
Wouldn't that kind of be the kind of thing that the local community would be offended by? That, yeah.
Do you know what's funny about this thing? I tracked down a picture of it, and it's really this marker. If you could, the picture I saw is like there's a small little country store here, and there's like some kind of a little gas station right here. It's sitting pretty unobtrusively stuck in there, and how that even landed there, I just think it's interesting. Now, one of the things about the 500, though, remember, they were very, very poor. So that means they start with 500. As they're getting across there, they don't have much money to start with. Halfway there, people start dropping out because they'd have to stop to get jobs, to raise some more money, or they're just going to camp out until they kind of get... So they don't land in Missouri with 500. They get there with about half of them. But one other little, they will land in DeWitt. Now, one other important note, I think, about the Canadian saints that were now mixed in with Kirtland Camp. One of the families that Arza would have been acquainted with was the Smith family, and there was another boy by the name of Sardanus Smith, the Smiths, okay? And on their way to Far West, they decide that they are going to fall in with this local community now headed up by Jacob Hahn, and because he's got a mill there. So the Smiths stop from Canada, the Smiths stop at Hahn's mill. And it's Sardanus that is shot and killed, and his little brother having his hip blown up. Okay. By the way, interesting story about the younger brother, William. He will actually be healed from all of that in a miraculous way. Someday we'll tell his story. And he will actually end up years later giving mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to Lorenzo Snow, who almost drowns in the ocean in Hawaii. But not mouth-to-mouth. He hauls him over a barrel, is what he's doing to save him from drowning. So there's, anyway, great story, sir.
Kevin, is it
Sardinius? Uh-huh. Yeah. I don't know how they pronounce it in Canada. Eh? Yeah, eh? Okay. And then they will land in Far West where they'll get a chance to be there for a relatively short period of time before they're driven out.
They really never stopped very long.
No, they really didn't. But we know where they stopped because when Joseph is, and we'll talk about Liberty Jail next week, but when Joseph comes out of Liberty Jail, one of the first things that he's wanting to do in early 1839, remember, he's going to come out of Liberty Jail, get in Quincy, get everybody up to Commerce, get Commerce settled, and then he's on his way to Washington, D.C. to kind of plead for the saints that lost all their land in Missouri. So he has everybody, there's a long list of all the people who own land in and around Far West and Adirondack. And he's going to present that at the doors of the White House to say, and in Congress to say, these people need reparation for the lands that were stolen from them by the mobs. But he's got a listing of who all owned land and where they were. So it gives us a great record of where they are. So we know exactly where Arz's family lands just outside Far West. Okay, and that they were one of those people who was able to somehow buy land and then it was taken from them. Okay. Now, so questions on any of that? We're kind of running quickly through history here. Okay, so let's now move on to what starts happening in what's happening in Far West. Joseph is showing up when he and Sidney get there. One of the first things that they're doing is they're looking at land and property around that area, and he will start identifying first of all what is Adirondack, and he will say, you know, I've got a revelation. This is Adirondack. This is the lone and dreary world, where Adam and Eve came after they were cast out of the garden. And I think I've told the story before that when we were leading an LDS tour group up there, I'd never been to Adirondack. So I was figuring, okay, this is going to be, there's nothing really to see here. There's a great big field. Okay, we're going to go out of our way to do that. There's not much to see at Far West. But how many of you have been to Adirondack? Okay, about most of you. And I remember as we're pulling into that area, and I'm just joking with everybody, you know, I was like, so where are we? I said, see every tree here? Those are all church trees. See all these fields? Those are church fields. You know, see all this stuff? It's just church stuff. Okay, we own all this because they're wondering what the... It's warm enough, Sydney.
We're cold. Right.
Well, then turn that up back on again.
Oh, I was thinking it was up here.
No, it's over there. Okay. Just heat it up. Okay, so I'm joking with everybody. We pull up and we stop at the overlook and have everybody get out of the buses. We had two buses. So we had about 80 people. And we just kind of spread out, and I said, okay, and then I'm going to come down here. I'm going to give my little speech about this is what is in Adirondack and everything. Guys, I lost it. You know, I'd been joking. This was kind of fun. Suddenly I went, wow, what I'm feeling here as I'm looking at this is incredible. You know, this is where there'd be a coming big priesthood meeting. This is where Adam and Eve were. I mean, there was just the spirit and the power of that. I almost couldn't get through my little spiel, my class I was trying to teach there because the spirit was so strong. And then, for those of you who've been to Adirondack, did you go then down the hill towards where Lyman White's house was and see Preacher's Rock? Yeah, big old Preacher's Rock, where we know Joseph stood there and preached to people. It's kind of right at the bottom of the hill as you're coming down off that overlook. Okay, just some very cool things that used to be covered with lots of houses when the saints were gathered there. But as they're gathering there, Joseph is involved in all of that. But there is a growing sense as the mobs are gathering that so much of this group was survivors of what happened in 1833 in Jackson County. And it's like, we're not going to be driven out again. That was painful. It's taken us 5 years to get ourselves back together. And here they come again, not this time. And Joseph is, I think he's a bit distracted with things that he's doing. And so there is a growing sentiment among some of the group. Interestingly, one of them is a man by the name of Samson Avard, who had actually gone to Upper Canada and tried to take over a branch. And he had some certificate from Kirtland that turned out to be from a kind of a rebelling group. There's a great story behind Samson Avard I won't go into, but Samson Avard is Porter Rockwell, and even Sidney Rigdon. There's a sense that we've been pushed, we ain't being pushed no more, and if they're going to start robbing us, we'll rob them. Okay, so very subtly, kind of in the early spring, there is the formation of this group. The common name for this kind of vigilante group was the daughter of Zion. And it was an oath-bound military society organized among the Latter-day Saints in Missouri in the summer of 1838 to defend the church from internal and external opposition. That internal thing becomes the problem.
I was going to say, you said internal, I went, oh dear.
Oh yeah, in fact, the internal, pushing back against the internal opposition was actually the bigger, and we'll talk about that in a second, okay? The official name for the daughter of Zion was derived from a passage in the book of Micah. And listen to the verse from Micah. Arise and thresh. Well, that's a good start. Arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion, for I will make thy horn iron, and I will make thy hoofs brass, and thou shalt beat into pieces many people. And I will consecrate their gain unto the Lord and their substance unto the Lord of the whole earth. Now, if you're kind of a backwoodman kind of guy, you know, and you're on the frontier here and your family's being threatened, it's time to thresh. And we will beat to pieces many people. The only problem with this, all along, the Lord has always said, I will fight your battles. We want to fight our battles, don't we? We want to fight our battles. And he's going, no, I will fight your battle. No, we want to do it our way. No, you'll do it my way. Well, that looks kind of wimpy. I know. yeah?
I just think it's interesting as compared to the how we... Our society nowadays, right? Because they got together, they had to create something. They called the Kirtland camp. They had
a constitution.
Constitution, right? Mm-hmm. They have to set this up because it doesn't already exist.
Yeah.
In a societal norm, where these guys are setting this up because it doesn't already exist.
Yeah.
In a societal norm. There is. I mean, I'm not going to say anything about how the world may go, but up to this point. Things are a little, we've been cursed to live in interesting times. But up to this point, somebody's not going to just come in and take our land.
Yeah.
That is not going to happen. We're not going to have
right.
the mob come over to Allen and say, you're not building a temple, and here, we've taken over the Fairview building. Right?
Yeah, right.
That is
And are we just going to put up with it, or are
right.
we going to organize some resistance?
Right, but as a societal norm, none of this would even be an experience for any of us.
Yeah.
We have to kind of put our minds in a different way.
Giant
pet peeve, do not blame people for making decisions based on the informational societal norms that they had at that time.
Oh, I like that. Yeah.
Well, and at the same time that this was going on, this whole idea of manifest destiny.
Oh, yeah.
was going throughout, was the norm in society, in our American consciousness. So it seems to me like they were thinking, you know, this is our destiny too, that we're going to...
Well, it is, but also in a where there isn't as much law and order. Remember, the norm at the time, think back to when Joseph and Sidney are tarred and feathered in Hiram, Ohio. There was a feeling among communities that their responsibility was to throw out what they call the blacklegs and ne'er-do-wells and all those kind of things and run them out of town on a rail. Nobody else is going
to
do it for him. So if this is an undesirable family in our midst, we will rise up and mob with pitchforks and torches, and we will run them out of town because we will police ourselves for the decent folk in town. And that kind of frontier justice and frontier mobs was actually kind of a... So part of what Joseph is always campaigning against is we're going to be the minority group and the despised group, but we need law and order to step in, and it's the federal government's responsibility. And basically, Joseph's going to be told that in Washington, D.C. We need federal troops to come in and restore our people to the land we're being lost in Missouri. And they're being told this isn't the job of the federal government. This is a state's responsibility. They were still trying to figure out what state and what federal. And it still hadn't been resolved from the Constitution. So if you're going to protect yourself, you can't wait on the sheriff to do it. And they will march up to, at one point, in the Gallatin Sheriff Black, and they're going to try and push him to do it, and he won't do anything either. So you know what? We're going to take it upon ourselves to get this thing done. But again, there are two problems. One is the external battle, the other is the internal. The more common nickname, Danites, was derived from the Israelite tribe of Dan, who was supposed to be the protector of the camp of Israel. The society was modeled after the Israelite armies of the Old Testament. We keep trying to say, did this early church see themselves as a New Testament church or Old Testament? Very, very Old Testament. Camp of Zion, Israel, Danites, we are Old Testament-ish. We are people of Abraham. We're having the Melchizedek priesthood, the priesthood of Aaron. Everything is coming from the Old Testament. It's not coming from the New. Okay, so they weren't going to be the Masadaites from the New Testament. They were going to be the Danites from the Old Testament. Okay, and we're talking about organization. They had companies of tens and fifties. But it also had officers like those found in state militia organizations. So you had Colonel Hinkle. You had Samson Avard. The society's constitution vested executive authority in Joseph Smith and his counselors. They kind of put the seal of the First Presidency on them, but didn't really consult with them. Although we do know that Sidney Rigdon went to a couple of meetings. And Sidney Rigdon seems to have carried more water for them. Joseph was involved in other things. And I think Joseph let this go on way too long. I think he knew it was there, but he was a little bit passive in pushing back on this one. Joseph Smith did attend one of the society's meetings and reportedly, according to them, expressed approval of its aims. But the precise nature of his involvement is really, really unclear because it's told later on through their eyes. Yeah, Joseph Smith knew what we were doing. The Danites began in connection with the effort to intimidate dissenters into leaving far west Missouri. Now, tell me who the dissenters in far west would be. Remember, most of the dissenters, they'd left in Kirtland. Who's the dissenters in Far West? Who are they railing against?
Last week you mentioned Thomas Marsh.
Thomas Marsh is not one of the dissenters, though he will be. He will Thomas Marsh is so anti-Danite. He's angry with what the Danites are doing. He will leave but he will leave primarily because of the efforts of the Danites. Who's the dissenters they want to run out of town?
Oliver?
Yes. Oliver Cowdery is one. Who else? W.W. Phelps, David Whitmer, John Whitmer. They're running out of town the first presidency that had just been displaced, but we're still living in Far West. So they're at, and according to its constitution, the society sought to protect the God-given rights of the Latter-day Saints and resist opposition. It also did promote political candidates favored by the first presidency and attempted to enforce consecration efforts. Okay, but more than anything, the first thing they did is that they will push back on these dissenters. Okay. Now, you need to know that later on in the Mormon War, in the autumn of 1838, and then primarily in October, the term Danites was used interchangeably with the armies of Israel to describe Latter-day Saint forces generally. Now, I love this little line here. It's actually from the church website. The popular notion of the Danites as an enduring secret society of Latter-day Saint Avengers far outlived the society's brief existence in the summer and autumn of 1838. If it's 1900 and you are reading all these little novelettes that were being written in 1900 and 1901, and it was all this stuff in the Wild West going on there, one of their favorite stories was Brigham Young and the Danites. And the Danites are Brigham Young's, and Orrin Porter Rockwell is like the chief Danite. Brigham Young's avenging angel. He's going around and he's killing people that are contrary to the church. And the term Danites just has this enduring sense. I'm really surprised. I don't think it did in this latest round of movies we're getting about the church. I'm surprised that they're not flinging Danites around at Mountain Meadows.
Is that what they based the movie on?
Probably, yeah, because in the eyes of so many, when they're thinking about Mormons being out of control, but those were some of the stories that when we start talking about the Utah War, and they're getting messages of the Mormons being out of control and refusing governmental oversight, what they're yelling about is Brigham Young and his Danites are out there threatening judges. By the way, the federally appointed judges that have prostitutes sitting on the stand with them, judging so they can offend all the Mormons. But those stories get left out, and in turn, what they're hearing in Washington is Mormon Danites running amok under Brigham Young. They need to be suppressed. Send an army.
Well, this most recent stuff in the entertainment industry,
yeah,
is acknowledges that it is historical fiction. And the writers, in some cases, have even claimed, hey, we can say whatever we want, and we can say you did whatever we want to say you did, because this is fiction.
It's just fiction. But we really want to make Brigham Young the big baddie, and the Danites his wing on which he gets stuff done. So, all right. Yeah.
Years ago when I was young, I remember hearing a story about a Mormon lady talking to a Catholic and saying, you have all sorts of problems. And he says, oh, well, just wait. You get big, same thing will happen to you. Because in the media, the Catholic Church is the favorite one to attack.
Yeah, it's been a whipping boy for a long time.
Yeah. So it's sort of a compliment. What I'm
yeah, keep thinking that this is a compliment, right?
Well,
But I think it's true.
They notice it now, and so they pick on us.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I will. But by the way, Cindy and I were listening to a great thing last night. I'll just pop this in there. I mentioned a while back that there's a prominent writer by the name of Jonathan Rauch, and he is he with the Atlantic or New York Times? I can't remember which one. Anyway, we listened to a talk that he gave along with Terrell Givens in Provo on Friday night. Fascinating, because he's been meeting with Dallin Oaks. He's been meeting with a number of things. Remember, this guy is Jewish by tradition, but he's gay. He's atheist, and he's a self-proclaimed New York liberal. He ticks all those boxes.
So he was born like 20 years too late because DEI is going away.
Yeah, that's right. He's missing that whole window. But part of what he was saying on Friday night is what he's been saying before is, I've been meeting with Dallin Oaks. I've been meeting with president of BYU. And in fact, when he spoke at another gathering earlier last week, both Elder Oaks and Elder Christofferson were both in attendance. And part of what Jonathan Rauch has said before, and he said again on Friday night, we live in a really divided world, and it's really polarized, and it's really bad, and Mormons are the answer. We need you guys to get involved. But it was funny. There was this wonderful little, again, side note, I don't want to go too far down there, but it's just too good. I may have to play some of it for you if I can figure out how to do it. Anyway, there's a moment with Terrell Givens, this kind of this church predominant scholar and Rauch, and he says one of the reasons he's an atheist is because of all the, that God should have stepped in and stopped cancer among kids, and he should have stopped the Holocaust and all of that. And right in front of this audience, he turns to Givens and he says, so explain to me why it is that God would let all these things happen. And Givens says, are you putting me on the spot to explain? And he says, yes. What's the answer to this? And Givens goes down an interesting road. He says, listen, as Latter-day Saints, in our tradition, we believe that God did not create stuff out of nothing, ex nihilo. Didn't do that. It was all there. So souls have existed for eternities along with God and their ability to have agency. And Rauch says, are you telling me that God inherited the evil that we see in the world? And there's this long pause, and Terrell goes, yeah, that's what I'm saying. And he says, wow, I must be a Mormon. Because basically he's saying, I don't have complete answers on all of this, but all I know is that agency reigns supreme, and people have the ability to do horrible things. But what he's looking to us is he says, Joseph Smith, And he said, oh, by the way, he says, I have to tell you, after listening to President Oaks and all the things, and listening to President Nelson talk to your people about peacemaking and everything, he says, I've come to believe that your full theological understanding of the world isn't really well expressed in the Book of Mormon musical. I think that might be true. Yeah, right, right. Yeah, because he just has this incredible respect for the fact that we seem to be more fair and more understanding, and the need for pluralism and how to accept kind of an interfaith connection with people around us as a way to resolve differences. So I think you're going to be hearing more about Jonathan Rauch because he's kind of the celebrity among the church at the moment.
What I've gathered from what you said about the Danites, that they really did more harm to the church.
They did.
Than they did, I don't know what all they did. to the family.
I'll tell you in a second.
Okay. But it seems to me, haven't we been, you know, and then this person says, we need to get more involved. Haven't we been cautioned to be very careful? Do not express political views at church. Do not bring him into the Sunday school lesson.
Yeah.
And all of that, to be very careful. I mean, we had enough political divide over the COVID mask and mask.
Well, that was fun, wasn't it?
No, it wasn't. I was Relief Society president.
I remember.
So careful about what I said and didn't say, which I always thought was so sad. I always thought we needed to be kinder to each other and more
important. It was vicious.
So there is a something to be learned from that. Yes, you may not, whatever is going on, you need to be extremely careful how you express your views, because in the long run, I mean, 30 years from now, if we hear, well, I left the church over a mask, or I was mad about a vaccination.
I know those people.
Look at you like, what?
Yeah, I know. I know.
Yeah, again, the political views. When I was a missionary in Italy a little over 50 years ago, we had some issues in some of the branches there, but there was one branch in particular that the branch president, prior to his conversion to the church, had been a member of the Communist Party. And those who were converts had had to fascist background would not come to church when he was branch president, and he was released. The new branch president had been a fascist prior, so all of the fascist converts started coming back and the communist converts left. And it took him a while to kind of sort things out.
Yeah.
I remember on one occasion in one branch I served, and one of the members, very faithful member, says, I should have been president of this branch. I was baptized 6 months before the branch president was.
It's just by seniority, right?
It takes time.
Here's Kevin's little prophecy over here. So I'm not over there, I'm over here. The church discussion in the next 6 months will be about immigration. I'm just saying, and I think we're going to have to be very careful about how we handle that topic, especially with Spanish branches in our midst. Yeah.
Even in our priesthood lesson yesterday, we were talking about, well, it was President Hinckley, or President Nelson's talk where he announced the 17 temples and talk about it. And I don't know if people were aware of it, but there was a non-member in our group. Well, they should have been aware of it. Anyway, the whole discussion, though, I got uncomfortable with it because it was talking about temple attendance and the experiences people had in the temple in almost an unrealistic way. And there were probably, there were a number of members that I know that don't hold temple recommends.
Yeah.
So I just think we just have to be really sensitive when we get into these. It's kind of mob mentality. We get into these discussions.
We do.
Discussion, positive gospel discussions. But it's a very closed-minded.
Well, and we're running up in a polarized world, and even a polarized. People are showing up at church on kind of these different poles because that's a discussion I want to have really soon. I've been doing some writing and stuff on it.
I've got a friend that told me, getting some of these discussions that we can have and occasionally crop up at church, is when you get into the discussions of the deep doctrine church, it says it's usually not deep and it's usually not doctrine.
Boy, isn't that the truth? Oh my gosh. Okay, so let me tell you kind of what happened there, and maybe this is a good reminder for us now. This says June 17th, there's two things that happened. One is June 17th, the other one is on July 4th. And Sidney Rigdon, the orator, the man that can stir up people much better than Joseph Smith can, because he just kind of he had been a Campbellite minister and he knows how to preach. But on June 17th, he will give what's called the Salt Sermon. We don't have, and I looked, long and hard to find see if anybody had actually taken dictation on the Salt Sermon, and there's not, other than just a lot of people reporting on the infamous Salt Sermon. And basically it says this: the Salt Sermon caused a great deal of demand to purge the church of any disloyal members. This included the formalization, I would say, of the seemingly unauthorized Danites secret military society for the enforcement of church orthodoxy. That was one of their things. 2 days after the Rigney sermon, 80 Latter-day Saints signed a statement, the so-called Danite Manifesto, warning dissenters to depart or a more fatal calamity shall befall you. And that was that was nailed on their doors. How'd you like to be Oliver Cowdery or W.W. Phelps, you know, who wrote "The Spirit of God Like a Fire is Burning," you know, and this is what's nailed on your door on the 19th. According to John Carell, an early church member and leader, the first presidency did not seem to have much to do with the Danites at first, but some of the Danites clearly saw the Salt Sermon as a sign of approval. So now we think we have the first, we're going to read into it that we have the first presidency guidance, and we're off and running. Carell stated that although Rigdon did not give names in his sermon, yet it was plainly understood that he meant the dissenters of those who had denied the faith. The dissenters, and here's the problem, the dissenters and their families interpreted these words as threats, as they should have, and they quickly left Caldwell County, Missouri. Their stories helped stir up anti-Mormon feeling in northwestern Missouri and contributed to the outbreak of the 1838 war. In fact, we know where they went. They went to see Governor Boggs. Because what will happen on July 1st, Sidney Rigdon, first of all, these guys are the disloyal members are run out of town. On July 4th, Sidney Rigdon's going to get up at the 4th of July celebration, and he's going to say, the upcoming war between us and the old settlers shall be a war of extermination.
So where's Joseph Smith doing all this time?
On the stand. That's why I say he seemed to give some tacit approval on the 17th, and he's on the stand and does his own little speech, but at this point I think he's overwhelmed and he's not quite sure what to do. Rigdon is stepping up and controlling, so is Colonel Hinkle and so is Samson Avard.
Is Rigdon second counselor?
He is first counselor. Hiram is second. So they will go straight to Governor Boggs, and they will be some of the signatories on the extermination order that will then be issued in October. And the word extermination was not first used by Governor Boggs. It was first used by Sidney Rigdon. Okay.
But extermination didn't necessarily mean what we think it
Yeah, it means to just drive him out, right? But still, I mean, we look at it now in horror, and in fact, it wasn't until, I think, Missouri finally canceled the extermination order. I think it was just before the St. Louis Temple was dedicated, I think. Yeah, they just finally got around to getting rid of that thing, okay? So what I'm saying is that, now, I was trying to think, by the way, as I was thinking about this, and just, I'm always kind of a bit horrified when I read through what happens here. I'm not sure what the saints could have done, sort of, to be honest. Now, I think they went way too far in terms of the people from Gallatin would come over and burn the farms in Far West. The Danites would then go and burn their farms, steal the stuff that was stolen, and they'd burn down their store and take all the food back to Far West. So that gave Governor Boggs all the thing that says, were Mormons actually out burning farms and burning stores? Well, yeah, in retaliation, but they were still doing it. And I'm not sure what else you tell the saints at this point who got kicked out of Jackson County at the end of a musket, and then it's going to happen again here. I don't know. I don't know what you tell them. We just get up and move again?
Which is what they end up doing. What
they ended up doing anyway, yeah.
It's a life lesson, isn't it? What actually brought down the Romans? I like time team. So.
Yeah, there you go.
But anyway, so it's a really good sound filler in my house. What brought them down? Internal.
It was an internal battle.
And so what I'm hearing here is a life lesson about internal strife versus external sources. What do we do? What do we allow external sources to do?
What caused the fall of Nauvoo?
Internal.
It was the internal stuff. The Nauvoo Expositor was not written by... it was written by people who had been endowed. So, yeah, internal strife, internal battles, I think, are a big part of this. I don't know what I would tell them, but here's what I know, and maybe kind of to start winding down here, I guess it's just a question that I have. How do we, could we, should we handle dissent in our midst? Yeah.
Drive the dissenters out.
Organize the Danites. Let's do this thing again. Yeah, Brent, and then
here. I don't know if it doesn't solve the problem. Abraham Lincoln is worth listening to. Every man. It says, "The loss of enemies does not compensate for the loss of friends."
Oh wow! Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that a lot. Charlie?
Well, I don't know. You know, there is a point where we have to stand for something.
Yep. Yep.
He gave an example of his priesthood lesson. My priesthood lesson yesterday was on giving blessings. And by the time we got finished with that lesson and all the comments, it was kind of an off-the-cuff lesson to start with. We agreed with everything. You know, nobody was offended. It's just kind of expanded till nobody would disagree with anything. And we have to somehow take a stand, and maybe truth is the answer here, you know.
But these days
it's offending everybody.
But Charlie, isn't it I'm going to live my truth. You live your truth. So it's not even my opinion anymore. It's my truth. So, and you don't have an opinion. You have your truth. So we're having to decide which one of us has the real truth and which one of us is deluded.
Only if your goal is to have the real truth. If you don't care about having the real truth, then...
Well, that's one way. Then I don't worry about truth at all. I'm just going to be apathetic. What Jonathan Rauch calls the thin church. We just don't care much about anything, and we give up our values. We give up what is most important to us. And how do we hold on to that but still allow for other voices? That's a question.
That's a hard thing to do. I mean, I agree with it, by the way, but it's you just every once in a while you get into a conversation with somebody and you end up just standing there kind of as a milquetoast, never really wanting to offend.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that in listening to Rauch last night, part of what he said was, in this setting in Provo with Terrell Givens and a room full of Latter-day Saints, he says, I love this, I love this, I love this. He says, I think the church is wrong on same-sex marriage. I'm married, I think I had a right to be married. And I think everybody else was able to say, I agree that that's how you feel. And it didn't have to be contentious, and it didn't have to... And they weren't having to say, well, we need to believe what you believe. And he was still saying, I don't need to stop believing what I believe, but we still find a way to peacemake between us without giving up our values. And I think that's the hard part.
Well, that could be an internal struggle as well as external.
I think it should bring an internal struggle, where you have to take a look at what do I really believe. And I think the internal strife starts there. I think that's exactly right.
These problems are not new. James chapter 1, there's a couple of verses there that the Danites probably should have read and thought about it. It says, therefore, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath, for the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God.
That's good.
Yeah, that's true. And so what happened is that, and in fact, I think it's Heber C. Kimball's wife, I mentioned this, Vallate, who's going to say, I agree with a lot of the views that people are expressing, but the way that they're going about it is wrong. How they're doing that, yeah.
I think if we're left on our own, we'd be a mess, and the church wouldn't be as big as it is. I think we need to rely on the prophet.
Buddhist Council.
And how we walk in between all of that. Yeah, I think so too, yeah.
Well, kind of feedback on that. The way the church is set up, do our truths really matter sometimes when it comes to the, you know, the way
Well, we're having to decide the things that we can believe, and then that means that if I hold on to my values, I still think there are bridges of understanding that I can form with people that have different beliefs than me. And I think in legal documents, they're always looking for those areas of agreement. If we're going to have some kind of mediation, let's start with the stuff that we agree on. You start there, and then you're going to have those areas where you disagree. But dissenters, I think, we need to find a way to allow those voices to be there and maybe not dominate. But
yeah, so the challenge, I think, and Bishop Hale brought it up about whether these doctrinal issues are doctrinal. I don't think we have any right to mediate on doctrine. And I think we get confused sometimes because we don't know what we think is doctrine might not be doctrine and things like that. But dissent, it's interesting. I don't know how you define dissent, but
that's a good question.
Five definitions of dissent in this term. Rebellion, and inside the church, I think rebellion needs to be
somehow addressed.
And
at what point does it
stay inside if you're rebellion? If you're in rebellion to the whole of the church, but people who have questions and who disagree is different than people who are striving to change the church's position through an uprising.
I know, and I know the church struggles with that continually. At what point does somebody who's agitating and activating organized public assent, at what point do we allow that their agency, and at what point do we then have to push back?
I think the example that I'm thinking of about 10 or 20 years ago, there was a brother who ordained his wife an elder out on the sidewalk in front of the
Yeah, right. For, yeah, I remember that one.
And excommunicated him for that. But I don't think they even excommunicated him for ordaining her an elder. I think they excommunicated him for the way he did it.
Maybe.
And of course, the ordinance wouldn't be valid anyway. But they allowed him to retain his church membership until his rebellion became so contentious.
Yeah, the church is always balancing those kind of things. Charlie, you have...
Well, I mean, what he's saying here, I mean, if there's no question, there's not an answer. So a question's great, but rebellion is altogether a different thing.
I think always.
Yeah.
You can't have rebellion inside the church.
But
all you can do is you can just say, okay, you're out of the church. You can't take it further.
Yeah, there's not much more. I'm not shooting him, right? Yeah.
A long while ago, I remember it seemed like there were a whole lot of BYU professors getting excommunicated.
Yeah. Well, BYU is going through a reformation at the moment. It just started in the last few weeks. Yeah, there's a reformation, and there's going to be dissenting on both sides about how they're doing it and how they're doing this. We probably ought to have a discussion on that, but yeah, it's happening. Yeah.
You know what? I look at the disputes and some of the problems that we have, and I think back to that great council in heaven. The goal was not disputed. Both sides proposed the same goal, worthy goals, except the methodology is where you run into problems.
Yeah.
And that's so common today. When someone has a worthy goal, but an inappropriate methodology, that can really confuse us if we're not very careful.
Yeah, because, well, again, we go back to the idea of what's truth, and if the truth, there's a nugget of truth there, that when you look at both political parties, there is truth in both.
I'm already sorry for that comment.
Yeah, you made this. It's your fault.
So repentance is live and thriving.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I think there are some people
people that just like to fight.
Oh, yeah.
They like to fight. Their families like to fight. They don't get along with each other or whatever. And it's, you just decide you're not going to be one of those people.
No.
Because so many things that you can get upset about in a year or 2 years are not going to matter.
No.
And, well, I'll quote Dr. Phil because I love what he says. You want to be right or you want to be good? And I think if you're not being good, then you're probably not right.
I'll take that.
Because whatever the issue is, it really doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It really doesn't.
No. And again,
if somebody challenges you, I'll just say, I don't know.
Yeah.
I trust the Savior will someday reveal what the answer is.
Yeah. And I think at the end of that, we can do that without giving up our values and giving up what's most important for us. So, welcome to my world, guys. When I'm doing marriage counseling,
the I'll send you a bill.
Yeah, those are those things we're always trying to wade through. That's why I think that there are always going to be like two truths. No, this is really true. No, this is really true. No, that's true too. No, this is true. No, those are opinions. That doesn't necessarily make them truths. So, anyway, I just think that one of the things that maybe I'll finish with this on is the fact that I love as we're looking at history. And on one side, history is a foreign country. They thought differently. They used different words that sound like the words we use now, but they used them differently. They had a different frame of reference. So a lot of times when we're looking at this, I'm trying to paint the context so you can see what's driving them and who they are. On the other side, people are still people. And a lot of the things that we struggle with are the same. We're the same. Those are people like us. And same. And so some of the issues that show up, like how we handled dissenters in our midst, stuff like that, are issues that are alive today. And they're issues that need to be dealt with. And that's why it's so valuable, I think, to look at history as how things were handled in history and then put what we're doing today against that and see what we do. And like, sometimes it gives us a roadmap about how we handle, because we can see how it was done in the past. So, anyway, I bear my testimony that, again, a deeper dive in our church history to me is testimony affirming, because I just see such normal people struggling and grappling with incredibly heavy issues, and I can see the Lord's hand in all of it, even while I see the weaknesses of the leaders that were struggling with it. And I leave that with you in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
All right. Can we get a closing prayer? And then make sure you take a few minutes, and you got a fabulous history sitting right here that I would take a second to go look at.
And also some goodies.
And some goodies. You can munch cookies while you look at Joseph Smith's signature.
And thank you for joining us for another Monday morning class. Hope you enjoyed it. If you have any suggestions about future topics that we could discuss, or if you had any questions concerning something that you heard in the class, please drop us a note. We'd love to hear from you. As always, if you happen to be in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, please come in and join us on a Monday morning. We'd love to see you and identify who you are. If the podcast itself is resonating with you, go ahead and click subscribe so that Apple can figure out where we are. We'd love to hear from you. So again, thank you for coming, and we'll see you for another Monday morning class.